Good morning, Zbyszek Zelinski here, standing in for Marian. The celebrations had barely died down in Cork after their win over Dublin in the hurling semi-final last Sunday, when the rebel county had another reason to cheer. Shortly after 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning, Rob Heffernan walked his way to a gold medal at the World Athletics Championship in Moscow. Dave Hooper reported on the last few hundred metres of the race.
Rob Heffernan is 150 metres away from a gold medal at the World Championship. Heffernan will come down onto the home straight. He'll join the greats of Irish athletics, Sonny O'Sullivan and Eamon Coughlin. Heffernan, the man from Cork who was heartbroken last year in London, has entered the home straight. The Russian officials in front of me have put the finish line out in front of him as Rob Heffernan is to be declared the world champion for 50 kilometres walk. Heffernan comes down the home straight at a time of 3 hours 37.49 on the clock in front of me. He saluted me as he walked around the track, and with 2 metres to go, Rob Heffernan is the champion of the world! Rob Heffernan is the champion of the world in 3 hours 37.56. The little man from Cork has won the world championship here in Moscow. He looks up to me and carries the tricolour in front of him. He's just grabbed by a couple of officials and brought off track. He's beaten the cream of Russia in the lion's den.
Darren Frehill and Miles Dungan caught up with Rob straight after his win on the Today programme.
It's surreal, you know. It's just a great feeling. Like when I came into the stadium, it just felt like another body experience. You know, looking at the screen and, you know, it's hard to take it all in at the moment. Like, but yeah, I'm delighted. You know, I said earlier on in the year that I wanted it to be a rocky scenario in Moscow. I wanted to go into Moscow and take on the Russians in Moscow. So. And that's what I did. So I'm very proud. Like, I'm very proud that an Irishman could come to Russia and beat him, like, in walking, you know.
Rob, Miles Dungan here. Congratulations to you. Well done.
Thanks, Miles.
Eamon Coughlin, Sonny O'Sullivan, Rob Heffernan. How does it feel to be part of that pantheon?
It's unbelievable. I didn't get carried away for any part of the race, you know. I was just working K by K, and I tried not to get emotional about anything, and, you know, and I just, it was only coming into the stadium, I felt as if I was watching myself on the outside, like, you know, looking at myself on the big screen. I was like, this fella looks good, man.
The theme from Rocky there for Rob, who took on the Russians on their own turf and won. It was a nerve-wracking morning for Rob's father, Bobby.
Love of God, the last 5 kilometres, I just couldn't put up with it at all. I had to walk out the door and walk up there in Ann Road up and down. And eventually I came back down because I thought he was on one red card, that he had one red card left. And I said, he's never going to do it, he's going to get disqualified. And my heart was racing at 150 miles an hour. And I just couldn't, you know, bear to watch it. But I did in the end. So when he came into the stadium, you know, and my son turned around, he said, he have a one now. I said, he haven't won yet, Elton, says I, although he's inside the stadium. I said, he can still get disqualified. But Elton turned around, he said to me, Lux, he's inside the stadium, he can't. I said, he certainly can. I said, the only way I know that he can lose it, if he get a heart attack.
Stop.
But he got there, anyhow.
He did get there.
Bobby Heffernan spoke to Brenda Donoghue on Wednesday's Mooney Show. Rob had to withdraw from the last World Championship in 2011 when his mum died suddenly. He was thinking of her as he approached the finishing line in Moscow.
Yeah, I was, to be honest. Like I came home from Dago a couple of years ago, and it was, you know, people go on about the disappointment of sport and the... You know, when my mother passed away, it was the saddest time of my life. Like, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. And, you know, when I was going through today and when things were good, I was like going, you know, this, you know, you have to appreciate the good times and when things feel good, and you have to enjoy them. Like, so.
And then on Thursday, we heard this.
Here he is. Can you believe it? There was gold at the end of that particular rainbow for Robert Heffernan of Ireland at the age of 35. My word. Did he walk to immortality? Fourth in the Olympic Games last year. Well, this is compensation with interest. Gold for Ireland.
Congratulations to Rob Heffernan on his gold medal. We're delighted for him. It was probably a sleepless night on Tuesday for the 55,000 students and their families who are waiting on their leaving cert results. On Wednesday morning, the wait was over. For some, the journey towards the leaving cert had been more complicated and a little bit longer than for others. 37-year-old father of three, Brian Ahern, left school at 16. He returned to education at the Limerick Adult Education Centre, and on Wednesday he got 5 honours, all A's and B's. He spoke to Cathy Halloran on the News at One.
And what are you hoping to do now?
I'm aiming to get into mechanical engineering. That's my aim, you know. Hopefully, that's where I'm aiming to go. Physical aspect in my last work, I can't do anymore, the physical intensity, so I'm going into something else that I can use my brain power with.
Going back to school for 46-year-old Mike Harrington was an even bigger leap than it is for many.
I've left school when I was 14 and I had very little education. I found it very hard to read and write. And I arrived back in here and just came to the door and asked them, is there any way I could go back? And this year I came back and I done my leaving and I got a C, two C1s and 3 B2s.
5 honours, it looks to me, in the old days.
Yeah, that's for someone that found it very extremely hard to read and write when I came back here first. And my teachers are over the moon at the moment.
You must be delighted.
I'm trying to hold it until later, till I have a couple of pints and we'll have a right little chat about it in the pub.
There were a lot of smiling faces outside Coláiste na Corriba in Galway.
I feel delighted. Yeah, you know, I was so nervous last night. Could hardly sleep, and then I woke up and I couldn't get back to sleep. I woke up so early. And now that I got them, I'm just overwhelmed with the result itself.
Any harm to ask you how many points?
550.
What course are you hoping to go for at third level?
Financial Maths and Economics in Galway. It was 430 points last year, so I should be safe now.
And it must be a relief for your parents that you're going to study locally.
Yeah, the cost was kind of one of the factors in deciding where I went. So I'm happy enough to be staying in Galway myself. Both my brothers did it, and I'm happier to be staying here as well.
You're here with your results, but you've been waiting with a dog, a little puppy.
Yeah, I have. His name is Archie. He's only 10 weeks old, so we couldn't leave him at home for today.
I suppose it was a great comfort to have the dog with you, that no matter what you got, he was going to approve of you and think you were wonderful.
Yeah, definitely. It's lovely to have that unconditional love, and I thought I might be crying into his fur, but it's been okay.
You were looking for high points.
Yeah, I was going for medicine, so that's obviously always a tall order. But yeah, I did fine. I got the 7A1s, actually. So
my goodness.
Yeah, so I should be set. Just have to wait for Monday now, I suppose.
And 7A1s gives you how many points?
That's 625, because I had honours maths as well. And you can just count 6 subjects.
Are you blown away?
Yeah, I'm really surprised. I wasn't really expecting it at all. Like I go to Coláiste na Corriba, it's just, like, the school has been great as well. Like, you can't thank the teachers enough, you know. It's half them and half me, or even more them.
7A1s. Well done. Frances Shanahan there, reporting for Drive Time. She also spoke to one anxious mum. Gráinne Burke was waiting for her son Sean to emerge with his results.
Your son is still inside looking at his marks.
He is, yeah. And I wish he would come out, because I'm ready to kill him. Oh, I see him now.
I got a 415 and absolutely over the moon with that now. I wasn't really expecting that at all, to be honest. Absolutely shocked, and I'm quite sure I've got something anyways. Like, you know, I've second choice. I'm out of Thume anyway, but just absolutely delighted to have it out of the way.
What course have you applied for at third level?
Multimedia, been a DCU as first choice, and then a second choice I have Communication Studies, also up in DCU. Yeah, sure, we'll see how it goes. Just,
you'll be leaving Galway. It's going to be an expensive business going to study in Dublin.
Yeah, true. It's dead right. Like, you know, it's going to be quite expensive living away from home.
And Mum, delighted?
I'm absolutely thrilled.
And you have other students in education?
I do. I have 6 altogether, so this is the 4th lad.
Lean times ahead.
Yes, yeah, indeed. I'll beg, borrow or steal. I'll do it anyway.
Gráinne Burke is prepared to make the sacrifice to send her children on to third level education. The rising costs of being a student in Ireland were highlighted in the news at the beginning of the week. Jackie O'Callaghan of the National Parents Council Post-Primary spoke to Jonathan Clinch on the News at One on Tuesday.
I would work it out at about €15,300 per year per student. That's based on a rent of roughly between €300 and €360 a month. depending on where the college is. It's cheaper in some cities than it is in others. Your laptop, your books, your utilities for wherever you're staying, your accommodation, possibly buses to and from college if you're not near enough, and all the other ancillary things that go with going to college for first year.
How much of a strain is this on families, and how important is grant aid?
Grant aid is hugely important, but there's a huge shortfall between the grant aid, because the maximum grant would be up just under €4,000 for a full grant. And if you take 4,000 from 15,300, that's still 11,000. And if you knock just under 2,000 off that for registration, which is covered if you get a grant, then you're still at €9,000 that somebody has to come up with. And as you know, our students aren't really able to find part-time jobs at the moment. So it does fall to the parents generally to have that kind of money for that sort of cost for the college year.
And fingers crossed for all students waiting for their CAO offers on Monday, girls and boys. Oh yes, he's back in town. After a three-month absence, the statue of Phil Lynott is back on Harry Street, just off Grafton Street, in Dublin. It's a great present for all Phil's fans, especially as this is his birthday weekend. His mum, Philomena, is delighted too.
One day I was down there having a coffee, sitting outside Brussels, and a crowd of French young ladies over on holiday, and they asked me would I take a picture of them standing around Philip. They didn't have a clue that I was the mother. So when they were all crowding around him, and all of a sudden I said, take your hand off his legs, I said. And we made fun of it. Well, when they found out I was Phil's mom, they couldn't believe it at first, but afterwards we got a lot of fun out of it. When I was growing up, Dublin was packed with statues, but I never knew who they were. I only knew O'Connell because he was in O'Connell Street. But, I said, he was always covered in bird shite. So I said, if any bird shite's on Philip, I'll shoot.
Birds of Dublin, keep away from Phil. You've been warned.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Welcome back to Playback. Zbyszek Zielinski here. Shane Gagan was walking to his girlfriend's house in the early hours of the 9th of November 2008 when he was shot 5 times and killed in a case of mistaken identity. The assassination was organised by John Dundon. Dundon was found guilty of Shane Gagan's murder on Tuesday.
John Dundon sat in the dock of the Special Criminal Court this morning wearing headphones and listening to music as he was found guilty of the murder of Shane Gagan. The court found the evidence against him to be overwhelming, the three prosecution witnesses credible, truthful and reliable. Mr. Justice Nicholas Kearns said they were being treated as accomplices to the murder, but their evidence was corroborated by Garda witnesses, CCTV footage and other independent evidence. The defence witness's evidence, he said, was utterly unworthy of belief. The Gagan family did not make a victim impact statement. The court was told that Shane's mother, Mary Gagan, only wanted to say that the facts of the case speak for themselves. John Dundon's defence counsel said he deeply regrets the murder of the Gary Owen rugby player, but claims he had no hand, act or part in it. The 30-year-old was taken away to begin a life sentence for the murder.
The murder was a watershed moment in Limerick, with people protesting against the spread of gangland culture. Putting John Dundon behind bars has already had a big impact on the city.
This man was the leader of the largest and most dangerous criminal gang in Limerick, if not in the country. And today he has been jailed for life for murder. He didn't pull the trigger, but he ordered the killing. And to convict a man of that calibre and at that stature in organised crime is quite significant. Not only that, the McCarthy-Dundon gang has been broken up, as well as other gangs in Limerick. There were over 60 criminals jailed in the crackdown. 27 hardcore gang members are still in prison. Organised crime is down dramatically in Limerick. Shootings dropped from 105, that's 2 a week, in 2007 to 7 last year, and there hasn't been a murder in Limerick in 19 months. In this case, the Gardaí broke the gang from within. Close associates were persuaded to give evidence, April Collins, Lisa Collins, Christopher McCarthy, and often in cases involving gangland criminals and organised crime, you have to break the gang from within, and the fact that the Gardaí were able to convince them to do that is remarkable, and the fact that the court has upheld their evidence is also highly significant. In this case also, we saw that a rival gang leader was prepared to cooperate with the Gardaí, and I think what it also shows is that the institutions of the state have stood up to organised crime. The Gardaí, the Director of Public Prosecutions, the prosecution system, the court service, the three judges sat through their vacation time and this case was heard right to the end. The institutions of the state have shown that they do work and can work in relation to organised crime, and in many ways the state's authority has been established in this case.
RTE's crime correspondent Paul Reynolds on the News at One. Dr. Niamh Hourihan is the editor of Understanding Limerick, Social Exclusion and Change. Mary Wilson asked her why the gangland culture took over the city. Why Limerick?
I think if we can look to one factor which created particularly severe problems in Limerick in relation to gangland activity, it would have been housing policy, in the sense that there was still in the 1960s in Limerick slums and tenements, and the city fathers embarked on a huge amount of building in terms of new estates of local authority houses. Even though these were large and they had very little in the way of services, certainly for most of the 1970s, these were really successful estates which were relatively good places to live. But in the early 1980s, as a consequence of a government policy called the £5,000 grant scheme, a lot of the families in those estates who were employed, who were better off, took this £5,000 grant and moved out. And what was left behind then were pockets of these areas which had very, very high concentrations of disadvantage in terms of unemployment, in terms of single parenthood, and particularly in terms of issues in relation to addiction. And what we saw then emerging in those pockets is, I suppose, the beginnings of a criminal gangland culture. And I suppose what we see happening in the 1990s is the drugs boom in Ireland, the growth of club culture, the demand for drugs like cocaine and ecstasy. And this group were poised to take advantage of that.
Drugs were at the centre of another big news story this week. 20-year-old Michaela McCollum Connolly from Dungannon in County Tyrone and 19-year-old Melissa Reid from Scotland were travelling from Lima in Peru to Madrid in Spain when they were arrested on suspicion of drug trafficking when 11 kilos of cocaine was found in their luggage. Peruvian police released a video of the two women being questioned just after their arrest.
What's your name?
Melissa Reid.
Yeah. What's your nationality?
British.
Yeah. You were travel up? Travel arrive.
Where was
up?
I going to?
Si, the going to?
Madrid, Mallorca.
Mallorca.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Este. Which airline?
Air Europa.
Air Europa. And your note to contain this bag?
I was forced to take these bags in my luggage.
Yeah. Your note contain drugs?
I did not know that.
No sabe. No sabe si contiene drogas, solamente lo que está en su ticket.
Melissa Reid answering questions of the Peruvian police. Michael Russell, the former honorary Irish consul in Peru, visited Michaela and Melissa in jail. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, he shed more light on the chilling events leading up to their arrest.
They didn't know each other previously. That's really important, because that means there was no conspiracy contained. They both were working in separate places in Ibiza, and that their story is that, Michaela is that she was lured by a guy and then taken to a safe house in Ibiza, and there, from what I understand, went to Menorca, the Spanish part of Ceuta, Morocco, and into Madrid, where she teamed up with the other girl whom she hadn't met before, came to Peru. They were supposed to act like tourists, went to Cusco, came back, and then we were being watched at all times, and we're kept in a house here with, she said one time she mentioned five men with guns, and then we were taken to the airport and told that some people would be watching them, that they had to take these suitcases back to Spain. What they said is that they were constantly in the company of one or more men with guns, and were told that they're being constantly watched and with people by guns, and if they didn't do the wrong thing, they would be shot. At least that's what they believe.
Peter Madden, a solicitor representing Micaela, has travelled to Peru. Before he left for Lima, he said that she was going to deny any allegations if charged. The pair may be held pre-charge for up to 30 days and could spend up to 3 years in prison before a trial. Now, a redhead king and queen will be crowned in Crosshaven in County Cork during the Irish Redhead Convention next weekend. It's a festival of ginger-loving madness and a celebration of all things to do with having fabulous red hair. Jolene Cronin is behind it.
So the type of things that we do are quite varied, from the most freckles per square inch competition to a ginger chef cook-off to crowning our new redhead king and queen. We've got redhead performers, musicians, a theatre performance.
Best red eyebrows. That's one of my favourites.
That always gets a laugh, as does the best red beard, the largest red family, the best wannabe redhead, and so on.
And this year you've made it into a full weekend.
That's right. I suppose it wasn't through a shortage of ideas really that contained us to one day in the past. But this year we're going to go for a whole weekend event. And I guess with the whole Gathering Ireland initiative and, you know, the emphasis that's put on Ireland as a tourism destination this year, it's really kind of given us the incentive and the encouragement to, you know, go for a whole weekend full of events.
Did I hear Jolene correctly? The best red beard? I might have to travel down to Crosshaven myself. People with red hair sometimes attract too much attention and not always positive. So remember that
only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. So listen to me, if you care for your health, you won't call me ginger, lass, you ginger yourself, yeah. Only a ginger can call.
Wise words there from the comedian Tim Minchin. People picking on those with red hair should think twice, though. It appears that redheads are better evolved. It's a scientific fact, no less, and here's Alistair Moffat explaining all to Catherine Thomas on The John Murray Show.
All physical colouring, okay, is a mixture of two pigments in your body, black melanin and red or yellow melanin. And in redheads, what happens is that a particular receptor in the pathway that gives you pigmentation, called MC1R, it gets disrupted. And black melanin is suppressed while red or yellow melanin is allowed to be made. And the result of that is red hair, light skin color, often freckles. Jolene was talking about freckles per square inch, and a greater sensitivity to sunlight. And we believe that that's one of the reasons, one of the evolutionary reasons for red hair. In the cloudier countries of northwestern Europe, like Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, and England to an extent, in those cloudier countries, it's harder to get enough vitamin D, which is what you get from sunshine. Mm. And if you have red hair, you're better evolved.
So we're more genetically evolved, do you think?
Yes, you're adapting to the climate. So people with red hair ought to be congratulated for having smarter genes.
Ha! I knew that my red beard was a sign of something. And for more information about the Irish Redhead Convention, you can visit redheadconvention.com. Recently, during the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, Canadian redhead comedian Sean Hitchens organised a ginger pride walk. Sean is gay and a known sperm donor to a lesbian couple.
Well, it was one very awkward coffee conversation with two of my best friends. You know, it's very interesting because I'm paralleling my experience as a gay man with having red hair, and just trying to figure out, you know, how are we both discriminated against today? like redheads aren't allowed to donate sperm to a Danish bank anymore. They're unwanted. So, you know, in Canada, as a gay man, if you want to donate sperm, you can't go through a clinic because you'll be rejected.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I'm trying to figure out, you know, just the way that you're born or has determined what you can and can't do.
Sean Hitchens there, speaking to Catherine Thomas on The John Murray Show. Sean is a part of a non-traditional family. That topic was also explored by Anya Lawler last Sunday. Her guest, Colm O'Gorman, is the executive director of Amnesty International Ireland. He is married to his partner Paul, and together they're dads to two teenagers, Sean and Sophia. Anya asked Colm whether he was concerned before moving back to Ireland from London with the kids.
It was 2003 when we'd moved back, and we hadn't expected to move back. We moved back to Ireland rather suddenly because of 1 in 4 and getting that set up here. And when we moved back and we found ourselves living in North Wexford in a very rural area, I'd been out of Ireland for 17 years. I had lots of concerns, you know, sending him to the local Catholic national school. I had all kinds of concerns about that. I mean, they're all from mixed race. The mother's Kenyan. So there were huge, huge concerns about what their experience might be. So we actually set up an Educate Together school to make sure that they would have the kind of education and experience that we wanted to have, one that respected and cherished and celebrated them. I have to say, it's been phenomenal. And never once, and I asked them this even yesterday, because I've said it a couple of times, but I wanted to make sure it was still true for them. Never once has anybody made any kind of pejorative, negative, suspicious comment or any questioning comment about their family, about who they are. Sophia actually said to me yesterday when I asked her this question, she said, actually, most of them are really jealous and think it's really cool, because generally speaking, it's their dads who spoil them. So they think, mistakenly, she added really quickly, that means we get doubly spoiled because we've got two dads. So they've never had, I mean, our community, and as I say, we live in a very rural part of North Wexford, just beyond Goree Town. And the kids go to Goree Community School, which is a huge but fantastic school. It's been fantastic. I mean, there's never been any issue, never been any concern. It's been wonderful.
And how right Colm is. Goree Community School is a fantastic school, producing the only student to get 9 A1s in the Leaving Cert results this week. Well done, Mark Burney. And it is heartening to hear Colm talking about the great welcome they've received from their community. But problems still persist. Denise Charlton and her partner Paula are mums to two young boys. While people treat them as an ordinary family, they aren't one in the eyes of the law.
I mean, I remember telling my father I was pregnant, and he looked at me and he said, better change the will then. You know, there was complete joy, and Paula's dad, who's no longer with us, saying, you know, it was the happiest day of his life when he realised that he was going to be a grandfather. But the only thing I would disagree with Colm or would kind of may add to it is I think that there's incredible goodwill, but you are reliant on the goodwill of strangers, because the kind of legislative framework is very far behind how people respond. So people treat us as an ordinary family. Sometimes kids question it. But the fact is of the matter is that I am a stranger in law to one of my sons.
A stranger in law?
Yeah, so I have no rights whatsoever to Cian, and Paula has no rights whatsoever to Benon, because we're not biologically connected, we can't get married in the country, civil partnership doesn't sort that out. And so it's hugely problematic, things like, you know, signing a school consent form, a medical emergency, which actually happened to us. I was out of the country and Paula had to kind of forge my signature. You know, they're kind of day-to-day practical issues that are very real.
Denise Charlton and Colm O'Gorman were guests of Anya Lawler last Sunday morning. Now, going to the Gaeltacht is less Peck Sayers and more Daft Punk these days. Videos made by students attending Coláiste Lorgan in County Galway have become an internet sensation. Hundreds of thousands of people have been enjoying the impressive renditions of popular songs as Gaeilge. Micheál O'Fhuil is the man behind the project. He spoke to Catherine Thomas.
It was due to the weather, believe it or not. It rained so much in one particular course that we were inside all the time, and we decided to do something different. So we heads got together and we'd do some kind of project. And it was Michael Jackson was after passing away, so we decided to do a version of Thriller. and we spent 3 or 4 days, which got us through over the wet period. And at the end, we had such a great time, and everyone enjoyed it so much. And at the end of the day, there was really nice momentum of all their efforts. From there, it seemed a good idea to have some kind of project, as we call it, on each subsequent course. So 20 projects later, and quite a number of other videos later, TG Lorgan is it is being used. We're delighted that it's being used by learners of Gaelic, not only in Ireland, but all over the world.
The videos are worth checking out, and you can find them online by searching for TG Lorgan on YouTube. Here's their version of a recent chart hit, Wake Me Up, by Avicii.
Up on your feet, grim to hear, color even of me in heart. Down a sum, cobble, dare, scale. Ach, tamer, malachar. Dear, she long gone ago, satans. Dog and keel, revish. She must rainy lurking out of our shade. She towering queen. So, leg my steer on soon fire. Spawn and bow her is kakarum. Bon and me can't scream a mach shmine. Give it to the wind. So, leg my steer on soon fire. Spawn and bow her.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson. Podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer.
Welcome back to Playback. Zbyszek Zielinski here. Sean O'Rourke has been a well-known voice on RTE Radio as presenter of The News at One since 1995. From the beginning of September, he'll have to reset his alarm clock to get up at the crack of dawn. He'll be on the air from 10 here on Radio 1 following the departure of Pat Kenny. Anya Lawler was the first to speak to him. On Saturday morning, we learned about the more private side of Sean O'Rourke and the lasting impact of a friendship he made while working on the 1994 South African elections.
We had a guy who was a driver. He was a young man of 22. He had a child who he was looking after with his mother. Sorry, with his own mother. In other words, the child's grandmother, because the child's mother had AIDS and other difficulties. And anyway, Baldwin was our driver. And tragically, a year after the elections, he got shot. He was murdered in one of these bohemian places in Johannesburg for no reason at all by a drunken off-duty policeman. He just had a problem with his car. I mean, he was driving a kind of a beat-up car. So we said, look, we will look after that kid, and we took it upon ourselves to take him through college as far to educate him, to rear him, and to take him as far as his brains and ambitions would take him. So we started off very simply. We were asked by the family to put a headstone on Baldwin's grave because that was important in their traditions, and then that in turn led to us building a house for the granny. And then the child went missing for 2 years because the mother turned up and took him away to a township. And anyway, through the good offices of an Irish missionary, Father Sean O'Leary, we managed to have him tracked down through his contacts. And he's now, what are we now? He's now sort of at the stage of Deb's dances and the likes.
Oh,
and, you know, doing his equivalent of the Leaving Cert. So it's been a happy story. I mean, Sean O'Leary said, look, you know, we're doing this for one kid. But it's just, you know, but he said, look, you know, don't worry. He said, you got to do like Mother Teresa, you know, start with one. And then, you know, others will benefit as well.
Back in the 1970s, there was a chance that Sean would become a sports presenter.
We nearly didn't get you in News and Current Affairs. You applied first for a job in RTE in sport, is that right?
Listen, I did, yeah. Well, there's a bit of a long story about that. I was actually in the Sunday Press at the time. I was working as a sports journalist in the late 70s. And I applied, the RTE was recruiting a sports journalist for 2FM, or Radio 2 as it was then called, and I didn't make the cut.
You were nearly a sports journalist on 2FM.
Yeah. it was going to be part of the sports coverage. Now, as it happened at the time, they appointed the first ever woman sports journalist in RTE, and we got on well afterwards.
They got on very well. The young female reporter was Caroline Murphy, and they are now married with 6 children. Sean paid tribute to his wife.
And what did Caroline Murphy say, your wife?
I think I did say, you know, none of this would be happening without you. And she said, tell me something I don't know. So she's thrilled. Because I've learned a huge amount from her. She's a great critic.
Oh, that's
and a great
sweet.
Friend.
That's very sweet, Sean.
Sean O'Rourke will be on the air from 10 until midday on RT Radio 1 from the 2nd of September. This year marks the centenary of the 1913 lockout, a landmark clash between Labour and capital and between the big personalities of union leader Jim Larkin and industrialist William Martin Murphy. Citizens' Lockout 1913-2013 is a six-part documentary narrating the events that led to the conflict in Dublin in 1913. In the first episode, broadcast last Saturday, Helen Shaw explored the roots of the lockout and we were transported back to the Dublin at the beginning of the 20th century. One of the emerging key personalities of that time was Constance Markievicz, who, as well as being at the heart of the cultural life of Dublin, was also a close ally of both James Larkin and James Connolly. Her activism started with the fight for the rights of women.
The first step on the road to freedom is to realise ourselves as Irish women, not as Irish or merely as women, but as Irish women doubly enslaved and with a double battle to fight.
That's Constance writing in 1909. By then, she's increasingly radicalised. She's joined Maud Gonne's Éireann na hÉireann, Sinn Féin, and by 1909, she forms na Fianna, a type of Republican Scouts movement that trains boys in firearms. Historian Dermot Ferriter.
There are many individuals who emerged during this period whose background would suggest very little sympathy with the cause of Irish nationalism or the cause of Irish labour, and yet they assume very dominant positions. Constance Markievicz is one of those individuals. Herself and her sister were fascinating characters, a very interesting background, and yet they reject so much of that background and so much of that heritage in order to make common cause with the political radicals of the era. And the women are particularly interesting because they are battling a much wider prejudice. If you think of the difficulties that were there for male labour organisers or for male nationalists, and then multiply those difficulties by 10, you might get some sense of what the women of that era were facing.
You can listen back to the first episode of Citizens' Lockout 1913-2013 online on the RT radio player. The second episode airs tonight at 6. Wednesday saw the eruption of violence in Egypt when the security forces cleared up two camps set up by the supporters of the deposed Islamist president Mohamed Morsi. Over 600 people have been reported dead, with many thousands more wounded. The Muslim Brotherhood called for a Day of Rage march on Friday as the country braced itself for more violence. BBC reporter Shaima Khalil sent this horrifying report from the Cairo Mosque, where many of the dead bodies from Wednesday have been gathered. You might find some of what follows upsetting.
People are chanting, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, smell of decomposed body. We're being taken in into the mosque now. We're going in now, and the smell is so strong. Sorry. Okay. I'm gonna try to describe what I'm looking at. Dozens and dozens of dead bodies covered in white shrouds. And it's the smell, what you can't see here, you can smell very, very strongly. It's the smell of putrefaction. It's the smell of bodies decomposing, and you could see it. See the bloodied shrouds turning almost a brownish green because they've been here for so long, and someone has just uncovered a body, and it's a charred piece of body. I'm looking at a skull, and it's completely charred, completely decomposed. People are just showing us one dead body after another, and there's dozens of them. Dozens of them. I have been here many, many times throughout the years. I've never seen anything like this. People praying next to dead bodies. I've never seen anything like this. People praying next to dead bodies in the mosque.
Shaima Khalil reporting from Cairo. To stay up to date with the unfolding events in Egypt, listen to Radio 1's news bulletins throughout the day. On the 15th of August 1998, the Feast of the Assumption, the real IRA detonated a car bomb in the centre of Omagh in County Tyrone. 29 people were killed and 220 injured. Michael Gallagher lost his son Aidan in the attack. That Saturday morning, Aidan went into town to buy a pair of jeans. Up to that day, his mum would buy his clothes and he was worried what size to get.
Aidan was downtown. We never thought for 1 minute that people would plant a bomb in Omagh town centre, because normally these bombs are directed at the police or the army. But then I went to the hospital and it was a horrific scene. There was people, I could see people were walking there because it's only a quarter of a mile from the bomb scene. People were arriving in ambulances, in the back of cars, in vans. It was truly horrendous. A lot of walking wounded. We eventually went to the leisure centre where we got news that at, I think it must have been about 4 o'clock in the morning, that we had to go to the mortuary and there was somebody fitting the description of Aidan, so we had to go and identify him. And when I went there, there was another family there, and that family I later learned was the Monaghan family or the Grimes family, who had lost 5 generations of their family, and it was truly horrendous. When it came to identifying Aidan, that was the worst moment, and then I had to go back. And I just remember day was breaking, and I could hear the birds singing. It was a lovely morning, and I just couldn't believe that I had to go in and tell my wife Patsy and daughter Sharon and Kathy that Aidan wouldn't be coming home.
Michael has been fighting for justice for Aidan ever since. He's the chairperson of the Omagh Support and Self-Help Group. His son Aidan was 21 years old. Michael Gallagher spoke to Valerie Cox on the Today programme on Thursday. The death of your loved ones is always a difficult and emotional time. It's heartbreaking to say goodbye. Dr. Michael Smith, the Bishop of Meath, has made a decision to remove eulogies from funeral masses. No eulogies are to be given by mourners, and no poems or secular songs are to be included. Father Derek Darby is the curate of the parish of Ashburn and Dunmore. He explained the decision to Jonathan Clinch.
He's focusing really on what the integrity of the funeral liturgy and the purpose of the funeral liturgy. But I think it's also important to say that he hasn't banned eulogies as such, because our understanding of the funeral liturgy is that it centres around the Mass, which of course it does. But it also begins in the funeral home or the wake house and the removal, and also the prayers of commendation at the gravesite. So he has said, look, let's maintain the integrity of the Christian funeral and its purpose and essence, but let's also give people an opportunity that if they wish to deliver a eulogy, that they can do so in those other options, the graveside or the funeral home or wherever it may be. I could nearly with great confidence say that there's no funeral liturgy in this country that isn't personal, that doesn't involve family members, that the music isn't not only respectful of the Christian liturgy, but also that the music is expressive of where the family are at that particular moment in time. And there are certain pastoral applications of that, you know, that show great compassion and understanding to families. Like, for example, if we'd say someone, a family wanted to introduce various mementos or symbols that in many ways epitomise the person's life. That is done at various stages in the Mass with different commentaries that reflect where the family are at. Or if there's a piece of music at the end while the coffin is being removed, certainly the practice here is that if it's a contemporary or secular piece of music, the practice here would be that after the church service is finished, that piece of music can be played then.
Eulogies have been banned in Meath, but there are other ways of celebrating and remembering the life of those close to you. Mary Elizabeth performs non-church, non-religious funerals in crematoriums, funeral parlours, graveyards and in private homes. She spoke to Joe Duffy on Liveline.
What is the most unusual thing you've seen?
I have seen lots, Joe. I did see at one point a man got up to speak. It was his brother who had died. And at the end he said, I promised Pat I'd do this. Mm-hmm. And he took out a baby powder out of his inside pocket, opened it up, poured it onto the dead man's lips, then drank the rest himself and said, cheers, Pat, and sat down.
And what was your reaction?
I was a bit stunned. I wasn't expecting it. I didn't know he was going to do that. But obviously the family had some knowledge and they all clapped.
Okay, so a bottle of whiskey, that would never happen in a church.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
But it was funny. I thought it was slightly funny. And I asked afterwards what was the significance. And they said that the man that died had always carried a baby power with him. And this is what they wanted to do for his final moments.
John is from Phibsbro in Dublin. And he also witnessed a rather unusual send-off.
We had the can-can.
Okay.
The crematorium.
Why?
Well, that's what he wanted. That's what the person that died wanted. So, as you know, if you were ever at a crematorium, it's actually a stage situation. The coffin is up on a platform, and then at the very end, these curtains come across, these net curtains, and you can kind of see in through the net curtain, just looking at the coffin. And then there's a second set of curtains, and a thicker set of curtains comes in, and the can-can is going along as the curtain. So that was kind of the apt thing about it. But this is what the man wanted himself. It wasn't picked for him.
From Liveline on Wednesday. Derry City is alive with the sounds of Irish music this weekend as they're hosting Fla Hiona Héireann. It's the first time the Fla has travelled north of the border and the John Murray Show went there too. They broadcast live from Derry yesterday morning and Catherine Thomas was joined by Cara Dillon, who performed live on the show. If you can't make it to Derry, you can watch the Fla live between 8 and 11 tonight and tomorrow on TG Cahir or tgcahir.tv. That's it from me for this week. I'll leave you with Cara Dillon singing Hill of Thieves. Until next Saturday, have a great weekend. Goodbye.
For too long now, I've been a stranger here to the hills above Glenshin and your rocks and your rain where the silent soul haunt the prairie wall. In the wind they sing, come away, come away. To the murmuring stream, with the town below, and the babbling swell of the winding bow, and you still might hear the great O'Cahill. Come away, they sing to the Bannadi Glen. The hind of the plain has walked this land, and the loneliest man with his sword in his hand, and his blood runs still in every stream and glen, and his home can be seen from the hell of the thieves. Silent soul wants to pray.